please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
Climate groups raised the alarm and put President Joe Biden on notice after the Bureau of Land Management opened the public comment period for a proposed drilling project in the Alaskan Arctic that critics warn would unleash a dangerous carbon bomb and threaten pristine ecosystems if given approval by the federal government. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by John Quayle, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Critics Warn Drilling Project in Arctic Would Unleash Dangerous Carbon Bomb. Here's more. Climate groups raised the alarm and put President Joe Biden on notice after the Bureau of Land Management opened the public comment period recently for a proposed drilling project in the Alaskan Arctic that critics warn would unleash a dangerous carbon bomb and threaten pristine ecosystems if given approval by the federal government. Oil giant ConocoPhillips has proposed the oil drilling and extraction Willow Project in Alaska's National Petroleum Reserve, located in the western Arctic coastal region in the far north of the state. Hundreds of state, local, and national environmental and indigenous groups, however, have come out forcefully against the project and described the federal government's assessment of its possible impacts as flawed. If approved, the Willow project would be bigger than any other proposed oil and gas project on nation's public lands, and it poses an unparalleled climate and biodiversity threat that puts Joe Biden's climate legacy at risk, said Kirsten Miller, conservation director of the Alaska Wilderness League, following BLM's release recently of its draft supplemental environmental impact statement. The release of DSEIS, or Draft Supplemental Environmental Impact Statement, triggered a 45-day public comment period, which by statute must precede final approval of the project. While groups have denounced ConocoPhillips' initial 2020 proposal for the project as misleading and a plan that would lead to certain disaster for the region and the planet, opponents said recently that Biden's approval or rejection of the project would likely seal his legacy as a climate champion or a leader who caved to the interests of the fossil fuel lobby. Allowing new drilling in an area that is already being ravaged by climate change, said Miller, would put critical wildlife and subsistence resources in the crosshairs, and it would lock us into decades of carbon-intensive oil and gas extraction. Willow is a legacy-setting project that will test whether the Biden administration is writing America's course from a dangerous climate path, she added. Federal court last year put the permits for the project on hold, pending a more thorough federal review, and DSEIS is the result of that order. While the oil company has continued to lobby for the project's approval, an analysis of Willow by the Center for American Progress in March showed that the emissions resulting from the project, estimated to produce 160,000 barrels of oil per day for 30 years, would dwarf the greenhouse gas emissions avoided by fulfilling Biden's 2030 commitments on renewables on public lands and waters. Ellen Montgomery, Public Lands Director for Environment America, said the approval simply cannot be justified in the context of the promises that Biden has made. Montgomery said, allowing the Willow Project to move forward will harm irreplaceable landscapes and further exacerbate the climate crisis in a region that is especially vulnerable to rising temperatures. Biden has set admirable ambitions for tackling the climate crisis, but it could all be undermined if the Willow Project moves forward. The 250 million metric tons of emissions that would result from the project, she added, would be a carbon bomb that over its 30-year lifespan would be equivalent to annual emissions of nearly a third of all U.S. coal-fired power plants. Authorizing Willow would be a significant step backward in the global climate fight. We hope that Americans send in hundreds of thousands of public comments opposing this proposal. Now, in the public registry, public comments will be accepted by BLM during three public hearings in Alaska, three separate virtual hearings online and via this online portal. Speaking of local concerns, the State Director of Alaska Environment, Deani Chapman, warned that the Willow Project poses an existential threat to the people and wildlife of the Western Arctic. This is a proposal to literally refreeze the tundra that is melting because of climate change to drill for more oil that will be burned and make climate change worse, she said. The proposed Willow Project is absurd and Alaska does not need any part of it.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
After spending his first year and a half in office mostly trying to avoid deeper engagement in West Asia while prioritizing challenges at home and in other parts of the world such as China and Russia, President Biden seems to be making a slight shift towards dedicating more time and attention to West Asia. One of the main purposes of Joe Biden's visit is the so-called deepening of Israel's integration in the region. And moving forward with the Abraham Accords, which is the main pillar of normalization deals with Israel. But the latter has raised questions regarding Biden's foreign policies, as Israel itself seems to be the source of the problem in the region. From its atrocities against Palestinians to its continuous attacks on Syria and its repeated threats against Iran.
Well, Israel has been the problem in the Middle East since their inception. And even before that, when they were under British occupation, Palestine was under British occupation, the Zionists were the cause of the problems in the Middle East, going back to the bombing of the King David Hotel. So Israel has been a really terrible neighbor for all of the surrounding countries to them. You mentioned Syria. Yes, I was in Syria several times when Israel was being the aggressor and actively bombing the Syrian people who've done nothing to them. They occupy Syrian territory in the Golan Heights. Israel has been just a terrible neighbor to everyone. They've been abusive of the Palestinian people. I've been to the Palestinian, what they call camps, refugee camps, and these are 70 years old now. These are not new. These are established communities that they refer to as camps. They drove the people off their land. They stole their land that they have no right and no claim to. So yes, Israel is the nexus of the problem in the Middle East.
Now, despite Israeli crimes, Washington seems to not only integrate the regime further into the region, it also aims to advance its plan to upgrade defense cooperation between Israel and the Arabs in the light of the Abraham Accords. Meanwhile, Iran has reiterated that normalization of relations between some Arab countries and Israel encourages and strengthens the regime to continue its crimes. President Ebrahim Raisi in April even compared friendship with Israel to keeping a snake in proximity. Americans have been feeling the economic pressure of inflation in recent months, with surging domestic gasoline prices adding to that burden. There are expectations that President Biden's trip to Saudi Arabia will include a direct request from the kingdom to increase its oil production in the hopes of offsetting the rising costs for American consumers at the pump. During his campaign, Biden had pledged of making Saudi Arabia a pariah. But now, in a move seen by rights advocates as at odds with his promise to put human rights at the heart of U.S. foreign policy, Biden is set to meet with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman as he struggles to combat record-high U.S. gasoline prices.
Biden has done some very foolish economic policies in the U.S. Initially, like day one after his inauguration, he cut off the Keystone Pipeline, and he turned the United States from an oil-exporting country into an oil-importing country. What Biden was not counting on was the rest of the world is sanctioning the U.S. and not wanting to deal in dollars, and they're not wanting to supply the U.S. with commodities and or finished goods. So Biden's economic policies have been an unmitigated failure. And so, yes, Biden is going to Saudi Arabia to beg the Saudis to increase oil production.
Meanwhile, the United States is facing accusations of whitewashing the Israeli killing of Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akleh after concluding the bullet that killed her likely came from Israeli military gunfire, but stopping short of reaching a definitive conclusion in her killing. Abu Akleh was wearing a press uniform while reporting on an Israeli raid in the occupied West Bank when she was fatally shot in the head on May 11th. Since the killing, several media and human rights organizations have all determined that the Israeli military killed Abu Akleh. All this raises the question of whether the U.S. truly seeks justice and advocates for human rights, or it only claims to do so in order to move forward with its agenda.
The United Nations has warned the Israeli regime against forcible mass eviction of over 1,000 Palestinians from their homes in the Masafer Yatta area of the occupied West Bank.
Evictions that lead to displacement, if enforced, amount to forced deportation and a grave breach of the Fourth Geneva Convention and therefore constitute a war crime.
The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs added that the international humanitarian law imposes an absolute prohibition on the forcible transfer of civilians from or within the occupied Palestinian territories, and that Israeli authorities must put an end to all coercive measures, including planned evictions, demolitions, and military training in it.
Well, the Palestinians have been periodically rising up against this ongoing slow-motion Zionist genocide. It's been going on now. The Palestinians have been resisting this genocide for more than a century since it began, when these settlers started swarming into Palestine against the wishes of the Palestinian people. And so that struggle will, of course, continue. And there will be continuing protests. There are basically ongoing peaceful protests in Palestine. And every now and then, the uprising becomes more of a military nature. And then, of course, the Zionists respond in kind, and all kinds of blood is shed. At the end of the day, the Zionists are continuing their slow-motion genocide, but it isn't happening fast enough to save them. In the long run, the Zionist entity is doomed because it hasn't been able to get the actual acquiescence of the Palestinians, first and foremost, and then secondarily, the people of the region.
A ruling by the Israeli Supreme Court on May 4th allowed for the mass eviction of Palestinians in the area. The Israeli military has designated part of the area as a closed military zone for training, and the regime has sought to remove the communities on this basis. The European ambassador to the occupied Palestinian territories has warned against Israel's planned evictions.
If mass evictions and forcible transfer were to be the case, that would be the biggest forcible transfer for decades.
The official added that the EU hopes that upcoming visits of US President Joe Biden to Israel would put pressure on Israel to fulfill its obligations to protect civilians.
The US could stop Israel from all of its crimes if it turned and chose that path, but it won't. And the reason, of course, is that there's a lot of Zionist power here in the United States, including in the Biden administration. And they're sending a message by saying, even when Biden goes to the Middle East, and it would be in his interest and the American interest to have the Israelis modify their behavior, they won't do it. They don't need to do it. They're thumbing their nose at the world. And the Zionists have a long track record of things like this. They never compromise. They never try to go the extra mile to be reasonable.
Although the United States has called on the Israeli regime to stop its settlement drive, but in effect it has supported the regime in its crimes against Palestinians. U.S. officials have repeatedly hailed Washington's unwavering support for the regime. They have also turned a deaf ear to growing cries from various international organizations regarding the regime's atrocities. The United States has also vetoed numerous resolutions in the UN Security Council that criticize the regime.
Amid ongoing diplomatic efforts to revive the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, the U.S. has introduced fresh sanctions against Iran. Washington claims the measures target an international network of individuals and entities that allegedly facilitated the sale of Iranian petroleum and petrochemical products to East Asia. The move comes ahead of President Biden's visit to the region next week. Last week, Iran held high-stake diplomatic talks in the Qatari capital, Doha, to restore the JCPOA, with the EU coordinator, Enrique Mora, shuttling between Iran's top negotiator, Ali Bagherikani, and Robert Malley, the U.S. special envoy for Iran. Following the talks, Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, rejected claims made by U.S. officials about new demands raised by the Iranian delegation in the Doha talks, saying the Islamic Republic's requests are in line with the 2015 accord. He said, contrary to U.S. media claims, Tehran put forward no excessive demands that goes beyond the framework of the JCPOA.
برخلاف برخی ادعاهای رسانه‌ای طرف آمریکایی ما هیچ گونه مطالبه زیاده خواهانه ای نداریم هیچ گونه مطالبه فرابرجامی مورد ادعای آمریکا را نداریم مطالبات ما کاملا در چارچوب توافق سال 2015 است
امیر عبداللهیان's remarks came in response to US special envoy for Iran Robert Malley claimed that Tehran came up with new demands at the Doha talks. The U.S. State Department spokesman, Ned Price, echoed Malley's remarks, claiming that Iran has consistently introduced extraneous demands, demands that, or issues that, go beyond the four walls of the JCPOA. Iran is pursuing the JCPOA talks, while Israel has been sounding the alarm about Iran, its regional influence, and its alleged efforts of weaponizing its nuclear program.
And Israel is far from wanting the interests of the countries of the region. On the other hand, we see that the countries in the region like Iran, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Jordan, they're talking to each other, they're meeting in Baghdad. They've met several times in Arab and Middle Eastern capitals. So they are capable of sorting out their problems. And therefore, any relationship with Israel would be detrimental and against the interest of the countries of the Middle East.
Meanwhile, a top Iranian security official has warned against forming alliances with Israel, saying that such moves endanger the security of the region. Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, says that any alliance with the Israeli regime, even of a non-security and non-military nature, will pose serious threats to the stability and security of the Middle East region. Shamkhani made the remarks in a meeting with the visiting Qatari Deputy Prime Minister and Minister of Foreign Affairs, Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdul Rahman Al Thani, in Tehran. He underlined the emphasis on neighboring countries in the Islamic Republic's foreign policy, asserting that Tehran's coherent policy towards its neighbors is to expand all-out and strategic relations on the principle of good neighborliness. Separately, Shamkhani warned that the Islamic Republic opposes any move that changes regional geopolitics. This was in reference to a so-called Arab NATO, a plan that was a non-starter when it was introduced by the former U.S. President Donald Trump. This military regional alliance was due to Israel and the U.S. sounding the alarm over the perceived threat coming from Iran.
The Iranophobia is something very natural to happen in the West because it is one of the U.S. tools against a country like Iran, like Russia, who refuse to submit to the U.S. hegemony.
Iran has rejected such a notion and has said that through regional cooperation, security can be established. Iran believes that Israel and the presence of foreign forces are the source of instability. The UK Prime Minister fought as hard as he could, but he finally gave in. Boris Johnson has resigned as the Conservative Party leader. This will pave the way for a successor to replace him as a British Prime Minister after over 50 of his ministers quit the government. He will, however, continue as Prime Minister until autumn. A Tory leadership race will take place this summer, and the winner will replace Johnson by October. Boris Johnson's premiership plunged into crisis following the dramatic resignations of Chancellor Rishi Sunak and the Health Secretary Sajid Javid. Javid, who served as the Secretary of State for Health and Social Care, made reference to Johnson's failed leadership as the reason for quitting his post.
And now this week again, we have reason to question the truth and integrity of what we've all been told. And at some point, we have to conclude that enough is enough. Yeah. I believe that point is now.
Further resignations have followed, with the education ministers Will Quince and Robin Walker and ministerial aide Laura Trott quitting.
He had scandal after scandal, miscalculation after miscalculation. He's lost the confidence of, I assume, the country, going by the recent by-election results, and more recently, he's lost the confidence of many senior members of his government, with over 40 of them now resigning.
Johnson was under mounting pressure after apologizing for appointing MP Christopher Pincher to a role involved in offering pastoral care to his party, even after being briefed that the politician had been the subject of complaints about sexual misconduct.
He knew the accused minister had previously committed predatory behavior, but he promoted him to a position of power anyway. Why?
They're looking at the future. They're looking at the next Conservative government being returned in 2024. I believe they feel that won't happen with Boris Johnson at the helm. Therefore, people are jockeying for position. The knives are out. It's a Caesar and Brutus type political ending of his career.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson and the scandals that surrounded him drowned his political life, and he found himself to have fallen out of favor with the general public in the UK. Prior to his resignation, a snap YouGov poll had found that 69% of Britons thought that Johnson should step down as Prime Minister. The timing of his resignation could not be any worse. The UK is experiencing a cost of living crisis like no other time in its history. Many Britons are struggling to cope with rising fuel and food prices. Economists say that the country is now heading for a sharp slowdown or possibly a recession.
He is, for his own political, selfish purposes, been running this country's economy into the ground, and worse, far worse, he has been threatening a peace process. That's all I've got to say.
And things will get much, much worse before the next general election. And I think regardless of who wins that election, we will continue to see an economic crisis.
Now with a new administration set to take the helm in September or in early October, the real concern for the UK is how it will cope with the economic crisis until then. This is not to dismiss the fact that there are no guarantees that the new administration will be able to deal with the economic onslaught that will be piled on it.
I'm sickened myself and furious about that.
You are listening to IRIB English Radio. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
The limelight.
An estimated 20,000 gallons were leaked in the Red Hill Tunnel in Hawaii. This whole catastrophe has put the community's trust of the Navy in the dustbin. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Anne Wright, writer. This article is published under the heading Video hidden by U.S. Navy for 6 months shows 34 hours of spewing jet fuel. Stay tuned for more. A dramatic video hidden for 6 months by the U.S. Navy for the 34 hours showing 20,000 gallons of jet fuel spraying into a Red Hill tunnel and disappearing into a floor drain that sent thousands of gallons into the water supply of 93,000 residents surfaced on July 5th. After an undisclosed Navy employee made public a video that the Navy continued to maintain did not exist. What little goodwill for the Navy that was left in the civilian and military community of Honolulu has disappeared as the Navy continues to lie about the Red Hill jet fuel contamination of the community's drinking water. With the video taken by the employee whose cart ran into a pipe that broke, allowing the jet fuel to spray, available to the public, the Navy is investigating the media leak of the video, which it told did not exist for 7 months, to the state of Hawaii, its congressional delegation, and the public. Earth Justice Attorney David Hankins said that it's pretty offensive that they would go after someone that is providing information that the public has a right to see, that they're not apologetic for not releasing this information to the public and instead are trying to stomp it out is really, really offensive. The video surfaced only days after the Navy attempted a midnight June 30, 2022, out-of-sight release of a stunning January 2022 investigative report of the March and November 2022 massive leaks of jet fuel. The Honolulu Board of Water Supply and community groups, including Sierra Club Hawaii, Earth Justice, and Oho Water Protectors, had strongly called in town hall meetings and in writing for the release of information and investigation throughout the delay of 6 months between the writing of the report and its release. On Transparency and Trust of the Navy, Ernie Lowe, the chief engineer of Honolulu's Board of Water Supply, says, "This whole issue of transparency has always been a challenge. The Navy can provide the rhetoric to say that they will be transparent and build trust, but it's really the actions that are not consistent with that rhetoric that demonstrates that they're not being actually transparent, and that there may be more information that's available that could be very valuable in looking at what was the scope and magnitude of the problem, and what we need to do to recover the aquifer from contamination." The January 2022 report, finally released on June 30, 2022, stated in remarkable candor for an internal Navy investigation that laid bare the human errors and systematic negligence that allowed two catastrophic leaks to occur within months of each other. Rear Admiral Christopher Canva's investigative report revealed there was a culture of disregarding procedures, poor training and supervision, ineffective command, a lack of ownership over operational safety, a lack of timely, accurate, and thorough reporting, and a flawed investigation into the May spill. In the November 2021 leak, the Navy initially said that 14,000 gallons of fuel and water were released. But in fact, the Kavanaugh report says the pipeline was holding 16,999 gallons of jet fuel, which was released on full blast. The investigative findings mirror the community's decade-long concerns that Red Hill is fundamentally unsafe, a contention that the Navy denied for years until the June 30 release of the January investigation. They were right, Adam Sam Paparo, commander of the U.S. Pacific Fleet, told Civil Beat after a press conference to discuss the findings. The Navy was wrong to say that it was safe. That is clearly evident in the outcome.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
A major benefit brought by Imam Khomeini was familiarizing people with concept of resistance. This is the part of the speech delivered on June 4th, 2022 by Imam Khomeini, the leader of the Islamic Revolution. On the 33rd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini, greetings be upon him. One of the greatest advantages of Imam was that he familiarized the nation with the concept of resistance. It occurs many times that nations are after something but do not have the power to resist. When there is a pressure, they retreat. Imam built a nation like this. He injected resistance and steadfastness in them. That is why today the Iranian nation is a completely resistant and solid nation. Thank God, this is another blessing of our magnanimous Imam, and the term resistance he entered into the political discourse of the world. The resistance taught to the Iranian nation and all of us by Imam has turned into an outstanding term in the political discourse of the world. I would like to raise an important point about the enemy's greed, plans, plots, and foolish schemes against the Iranian nation. This point is made of two parts. One is that today, the most important means of the enemies to inflict harm on the country is to pin their hopes on popular protest. They hope that with psychological work, internet and cyberspace activities, with the various forms, money and employment of mercenaries, they will be able to pit the people against the Islamic government and the Islamic Republic. This is the first part of the matter.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The second part of the matter is that this calculation of the enemy is wrong, just like many other calculations made by him. In the beginning of the revolution, they promised that the Islamic Republic would not live more than 6 months and that it would fall. When those 6 months passed, they renewed it, saying that it would happen 6 months later. More than 80 of these 6 months periods have passed now. On that day, the Islamic Republic used to be a thin sapling, but it has become a sturdy and deep-rooted tree, and it has become stronger on a daily basis. Their calculations were wrong back then, and they are wrong now too. This calculation is just like the previous ones. An example is their calculation during the Sacred Defense era. They helped Saddam thinking that he would destroy the Islamic Republic in the course of a few days. They helped the plotters of coups, hoping that they would do something. All these were calculations made by the Americans and Westerners, and all were wrong.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
Guide me from all the ways.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد میشید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, if you remember, we had a survey of Imam Khomeini's testament in a number of episodes, and last episode, you heard the concluding part of the testament. Today, you're going to hear his marriage with Lady Khadija Saghafi. Stay tuned for more. Lady Khadija Saghafi was Imam Khomeini's wife. She was a virtuous lady while she was well aware of social and political developments of her time. A brief glance at her marital life shows that she was a very patient woman, as she had to accompany the greatest contemporary personality, Imam Khomeini, who successfully changed the course of history against the will of oppressors and tyrants. Miss Saghafi was the lady who tolerated the hard times of Imam Khomeini's arrest, several months separation, his life in exile in Turkey and then Iraq under tough conditions. This great lady was undoubtedly a major factor in all phases of the Imam's struggles and successes. Khadija Saghafi, also known as Qudsi and Quds-e-Iran, was born in 1914 in a religious family. Her father, Ayatollah Mirza Muhammad Saghafi, was one of the great ulema in Tehran, whose ancestors were clergymen for generations. Her mother, however, was from a well-to-do family. Hence, Khadija grew up with no financial problem. Young Khadija lived 15 years with her grandmother, who had no child. Yet, the wealthy life didn't prevent her from acquiring ethical merits. She was a hard-working girl, and she spent her elementary school and part of her high school to learn French. This enthusiasm for knowledge continued through her marital life, even when she gave birth to her fourth child. Lady Khadija Saghafi endured all problems of migration to Qom and living in difficult conditions with Imam Khomeini, as the Imam was a pain in the neck of the Pahlavi regime. Lady Khadija Saghafi loved studying and would rarely spend her day without studying a book or a newspaper or a magazine. Recitation of the Noble Quran was also part of her daily works. She had also studied the Divan of Hafiz, Gulistan of Sa'di, and many literary and historical books. She knew many poems by heart. Imam Khomeini's wife was so interested in reading books that the last years of her life she would ask others to read books for, as she could not read due to old age. Imam Khomeini was studying till the age of 26 in the holy city of Qom. He lived only with the money that received from his family in Khomein and would never accept the stipend that the sources of emulation sent to him. Miss Khadija Saghafi was introduced to Imam Khomeini by Ayatollah Sayyid Ahmad Lavasani and the former accepted as he had an old age friendship with Miss Saghafi's father. However, the difference of living conditions of the two families caused a wave of opposition against this marriage. Lady Khadija Saghafi writes on this, "The opposition increased. Basically, it was considered impossible that I would be the wife of a seminary student. For these reasons, my dear father explained in detail to Mr. Sayyid Ahmad Lavasani as why this proposal was impossible. My father had told him that this was very problematic. This girl would not be allowed to cope with the life of a seminary student. It is true that Mr. Ruhullah, Imam Khomeini, is very pious and God-weary, who has gained the degree of ijtihad at a young age, and he has studied philosophy and irfan, Islamic Gnosticism, regularly, and is a man of both knowledge and practice. I know Mr. Khomeini and I know that his knowledge is more than his age and he has a bright future. Yet, Qudsi and her grandfather consider a big number of problems. The proposal for marriage was presented several times, but each time the answer was disappointing. Finally, Lady Khadija Saghafi gave the positive answer to the marriage proposal after 9 months. The positive answer was mainly because of the three dreams that she had seen. Khadija Saghafi relates one of her dreams as follows. I saw in a dream that there was a small room in a house in which three men were sitting while I and a lady who had a special chador were sitting in the opposite room. The lady answered my questions. I asked her as who those men were. She answered, the man in the opposite is the prophet, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, who has a black turban. On his side, the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali, peace upon him, is sitting, who has a green turban, and on the other side, Imam Hassan, peace upon him, is sitting also with a black turban. I was very happy and asked, so these are my prophet and imams? She answered bitterly, but you do not accept them. As I was thumping my chest, I said angrily, what are you saying? I love them very much, and I consider myself among their ummah, and I have obeyed what they have said, and I will obey what they will say. At this time, I woke up. Thus, the ceremony of proposal for marriage was done shortly after the dream of Khadija Saghafi. Interestingly, the house of Khadija and Ruhullah was the same that she had seen in her dream. She writes, "The day after the marriage, I noticed that this is the same house that I had dreamt. This is the same room where I had dreamt the Prophet, the Commander of the Faithful, and Imam Hassan. Even the door and the window are the same which my mother had prepared for me after the dream."
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
As the race for the leadership of the UK ruling Conservative Party heats up, the fight for who will become Britain's next Prime Minister turns ugly. With bitter exchanges, leaked dodgy dossiers, and attacks on rivals' policies, the contest could quickly turn into a large-scale brawl. A flurry of weekend announcements has put the total count of top job hopefuls at 11, a large number filled with big and small names. Rishi Sunak tops with the most Tory MP supporters so far, with pro-Brexit Trade Minister Penny Mordaunt coming in second. However, critics say a long drawn-out contest will deepen economic uncertainty amid a cost-of-living crisis.
What we're going to be faced with is more of the same. I mean, clearly Boris Johnson brought the office of Prime Minister into further disrepute, and I just think that what we have before us are a number of candidates who are all committed to imperialism, all committed to neoliberalism. They're all warmongers at the end of the day. So we're just kind of rearranging the deck chairs rather than actually making any significant difference. It's a case of sort of parliamentary parlour games, really, rather than any meaningful change.
Onlookers also fear that the race is full of candidates who have a track record of concerning policymaking.
Priti Patel in particular, very close to the Zionist entity, had unofficial visits when she was on a ministerial tour when Theresa May was the Prime Minister and indeed got sacked as a consequence of that. It was Boris Johnson that brought her back in. But, you know, I mean, you just got to go through all the runners and riders. I mean, they've all got a very sort of checkered history, to say the least. At the end of the day, they're Conservatives and, you know, they support a system which has actually impoverished millions of people in this country.
It's not yet clear who's going to come out on top in this race. However, one thing we do know for sure is that the next Prime Minister of the entire country is going to be decided by a minority group, paying Conservative Party members, much to the frustration of the majority electorate who won't have a chance to say who the next Prime Minister will be. Robert Carter, London.
Apparently, senior officials inside the European Commission are not celebrating the news that Boris Johnson is to leave No. 10 Downing Street. There is a belief that his successor will still want to break key elements of the Brexit agreement relating to Northern Ireland. The EU accuses the British government of breaking international law by moving to scrap the Northern Ireland Protocol, which is designed to preserve peace in Ireland by preventing physical border checks. Senior EU lawmaker Guy Verhofstadt has tweeted, "Boris Johnson's reign ends in disgrace. just like his friend Donald Trump. The end of an era of transatlantic populism? Let's hope so. EU-UK relations suffered hugely with Johnson's choice of Brexit. Things can only get better. Analysts we have been speaking to are less optimistic. Members of the public in Brussels have been telling us what they think about Johnson's political demise.
I'm glad to see him gone. I don't think he was the cause of the problem between EU and UK, but he didn't help solve it.
I don't think the position on Northern Ireland protocol will change much, unless there's a snap election and then, say, like, Labour take over something. I don't think there'll be any change.
Former EU Brexit negotiator Michel Barnier has tweeted, "The departure of Boris Johnson opens a new page in relations with Britain. May it be more constructive, more respectful of commitments made, in particular regarding peace and stability in Northern Ireland, and more friendly with partners in the EU."
We asked the European Commission spokespeople if the EU's legal action against the British government over Northern Ireland might be paused now that Johnson is leaving the stage. They came back with a simple answer: no. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A fresh controversy is building in a Labour-held borough in East London as an embattled Muslim MP fights for her career. Elected as Britain's first hijab-wearing MP in 2019, Absana Begum's career started off well under the former leader Jeremy Corbyn. However, since Keir Starmer took over in 2020, things took an ugly turn, as local members in the safe Labour seat allegedly turned against her. Things became so bad that Begum was recently hospitalised and taken off work sick, following what she claims is a sustained campaign of misogynistic abuse. Despite this, a trigger ballot has now been launched, which aims to bar her from standing in the next election, a move condemned by her allies in Parliament. A former Muslim Labour member believes this may be part of a larger plot by party leadership to remove an MP they just don't like.
Absana Begum was previously subjected to a smear campaign where she was maliciously accused by a Labour council of supposedly committing housing fraud, and she was found not guilty when she was taken to court. And so this is actually the second attempt to destroy her political career. The people going after her are determined to stop anti-imperialists and practicing Muslims from being involved in public life. It isn't simply the case that Keir Starmer is failing to act. I believe that it's highly likely that Keir Starmer's office is directing this campaign of abuse, harassment and vilification against Absana Begum. And this is part of a broader Islamophobic anti-socialist strategy to rid the Labour Party of anyone who previously supported Jeremy Corbyn and, frankly, to rid the party of practicing Muslims.
The Labour Party hasn't commented on the case so far. Press TV's attempts to reach Begum for further comment was also unsuccessful. Starmer has been condemned by various Labour groups over conducting so-called purges of left-wing members who joined the party under Corbyn. Muslims as well feel very persecuted over their views on issues such as criticism of Israel and Palestine solidarity. The fact that Labour's first ever hijab-wearing MP also feels abused will likely deepen Muslim resentment in the party going forward. Robert Carter, London.
After 2 years of waiting for the Hajj, caravans of pilgrims and lovers of the sacred house of God have converged on Mecca. Nearly 40,000 Iranian pilgrims were also among the 850,000 foreign pilgrims who have visited Saudi Arabia for 2022 Hajj. Many of them have been waiting for years for their turn.
After 17 years of waiting, I was able to visit this holy place, and I hope all Iranians could one day travel to this sacred land.
I've traveled to Mecca after 15 years of waiting, and I hope all Muslims' wishes come true.
Figures show some 5.8 million Iranians are on a waiting list for traveling to Saudi Arabia to perform Hajj, most of them for over a decade. And this year, Saudi-imposed restrictions on the Hajj pilgrimage have dealt a blow to many Iranians' hopes. Ministry of